Voice of Music today.
Sunday Morning with James Jolly is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Adams and Bernstein, McGregor, Macmillan, Gilbert and Sullivan, Lerner and Lowe, John Wilson on Broadway rattles Berliners, Berlioz, Figaro, Romeo. Barenboim's Beethoven, Debussy and Delius, the Thames and a sleepy lagoon. 76 concerts for 2012. The BBC Proms, coming soon. A very special Proms season for a very special year. The 2012 BBC Proms. You can find the full programme and lineup in the BBC Proms guide or go online to bbc.co.uk/proms.
This is Radio 3. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Whether it's as actor, writer or director, the work of Stephen Berkoff has a visceral quality that demands attention. Plays like East and Greek hit you between the eyes, and naturally film producers have not been slow to make use of Stephen's ability to convey power and evil. Thus, I imagine, Stephen, that playing the hard man in big-budget movies like Octopussy, Beverly Hills Cop, Rambo and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo have helped to underwrite your work in the theatre and, indeed, on the written page.
Well, it has done this, and I'm very grateful to film for giving me the opportunity both to be in film and to stretch myself to the extent that you have to be a different performer on film, working with more detail, more, in a way, focus on the character, with certainly less freedom to improvise. It's very specific. And also, of course, from time to time, you have that financial remuneration, which does help, of course, and I'm very grateful to it, which makes me independent. So when I wish to do a play, I don't have to scout around too much and try to persuade people and come begging on my knees, please do my play. If I find they don't want to do it, I merely ring up a few allies, one or two friends, people I've worked with, and I said, so shall we do a workshop on the particular play? And I can pay them some workshop money, and then we get the play on.
Yeah. One of the luxuries of this programme is that you can have what you want for the next hour, musically speaking, and you've chosen to begin with, well, a rather good piece for a beginning, because it is a beginning, in fact, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, the one I chose, Darius Milhaud, is an astonishing French composer. He was born in that part of the 19th century and died in, I believe, in some time in the 70s, possibly. And I heard this when I was a young man. I was working, before I started drama, near Regent Street, around that area in a little shop. And in lunchtime, I would go to HMV in Coventry Street. And I'd look around, see what to play. And because of my curiosity, and also combined with a lack of really good formal education, it makes for a completely erratic and bizarre musical artistic taste. You are looking for something that absolutely turns you on, inspires you, moves you, and excites that imagination. So I went into HMV. I saw this beautiful cover, and it had Le Création du Monde, Darius Milhaud. I thought, that's the creation of the world. That sounds good. So I said to the man, do you think I could try that? He said, yes, of course. And when I heard it, from the very beginning, I thought, this is fascinating. It crawled inside me. It seemed to enter my brain, my imagination, my viscera, my stomach. I suddenly never felt such a sense of being part of music I felt the music was crawling through me. And I studied creation. Of course, this is the creation of the world. I saw the plants slowly cracking through the earth. I saw the shoots just kind of pushing their way through the solid dry earth and then opening, and the flowers and the leaves and the trees. It was fantastic. And that's how I discovered Darius Milhaud.
It's not hard to see why Leonard Bernstein responded to that music, so jazz-orientated.
Oh, absolutely. You can hear and you can feel a lot of that in his own music, of course, and even in his musicals, even in pieces like West Side Story, that kind of counterpoint, that almost strange combination of classical and jazz. And that's always appealed to me, because I feel that classical and jazz is a wonderful marriage.
Music from La Création du Monde by Mio, the Victor Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. It may seem curious to say so, Stephen Berkoff, but you were saying how that created a rather delirious sound world, a strange sound world, and in a way the next piece does as well.
Well, Benjamin Britten, one of the few composers who really express the spirit of Shakespeare's language. A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a beautiful play, half comic, half surrealist, half mystical. But when I saw the opera many, many, many years ago at Covent Garden, I was absolutely stunned by the music, and particularly for the fairies. And I felt somehow Britain had captured an ethereal mood, something that seemed beyond our normal consciousness. And, of course, Oberon was played by a countertenor at that time. Because I was so deeply impressed by him, I remembered his name. At that time, it was a man called Russell Oberlin. And the countertenor's voice is completely unreal. It's strange. It has a particular curious force to it. It has a dynamic to it. It's piercing. But it suited Oberon. So when Oberon says, "I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where ox lips and the nodding violet grows, quite over canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine." But when I heard that sung, it set my, at that time, hair on end. I've never forgotten that particular piece.
Thank you.
I Know a Bank from A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act One by Benjamin Britten. We heard Brian Asawa with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Well, Stephen Berkoff, we've come very happily to Shakespeare. And the next piece doesn't actually have words, but again, it's inspired by Shakespeare. And personally, I can't think of a more vivid depiction of Shakespeare than in this score.
Well, I certainly found Prokofiev highly stimulating to me. There's an energy, and there's also a vigour, a power. And that's, of course, to do with his Russian. There is something in the Russian temperament, the Russian background, the Russian schooling, the folk music of Russia, which they're not reluctant to sew into their music. And Prokofiev, the way he composed, I mean, I don't know so much about him, but the feeling you have of Romeo and Juliet is utterly astounding. Of course, he doesn't have to worry about language. Here, it's for dance. And so, in a way, he's a bit more let off the hook. All he had to do was express the feelings, the passions. When you hear it, you hear, you see, you're reading, you're absorbing the play. But what I get from him, which I don't get from Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, which I'm also quite impressed by, is the sense of rhythm. There's a dance movement. It's almost like a peasant movement. It's a power, a kind of vroom, vroom, vroom. This is thrilling. And I don't think Shakespeare could have found a better collaborator.
The Death of Tybalt from Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev. We heard the orchestra of the State Academic Bolshoi Theatre of Russia, conducted by Gennady Rozhdestvensky. We're going into a very different world now, Stephen Berkoff. From the absolute hurly-burly of the Prokofiev, we're going into something which is very consciously trying to find peace. And I was reminded of your book, your recent book, which I've enjoyed very much, actually, Tales from an Actor's Life.
Oh, yes.
And you talk about the incredible amount of time, especially in film, but this, you know, it's also theatre, where you sit around and have to find things to do.
That is one of the penalties of being an actor, particularly in film. It's not a natural medium, really, for an actor at all. But you do it because it's part of our, you know, 20th, 21st century. But film has to be done in segments, and it can take a time. And the actor here, you're really the paint on the brush of the director. You are just waiting for him to use you, scoop you up, put you on the screen, and so you can wait for a long, long time.
So when you're in your dressing room for the theatre,
yeah,
which is a very different thing,
yeah, yes,
that's when something like the music we're about to hear begins to be quite important for you.
Well, it's very important if you're doing a show, a live show, and you have some good music, because that will put you in the right mood. It will help you. And it mustn't be music maybe that overstimulates you. But when I was in New York, I was doing a one-man show in 2001 called Shakespeare's Villains at the Public Theatre in Lafayette Street, which is quite an established theatre. And I'm by myself on stage. And I was walking down St. Mark's, which is just nearby, in a music shop, and I noticed Buddhist chants. But I thought, well, I needed something for my little cassette deck. And when I played it, it suddenly felt, oh, this is so peaceful. It has a calmness. It has something in it that no matter what tension you feel, will gradually soothe you, will gradually melt that tension away. And I played these chants every single night, and I got to love them. And some are mixed with a little bit of a Western style and a combination. But there is this sound of depth in the Buddhist chant, which is very difficult for Western voices. Our voices have become tense with our needs and our hysteria, our neurosis. Our voices become higher and higher and higher. So when you hear this depth, you feel you're going to a place where human beings should perhaps reside at a little more.
Yeah.
You know, you were talking, Stephen, earlier about the coming together of classical and jazz. And there we had really a basic Buddhist chant accompanied by a sort of more pop-like simple synthesizers and harmony. And it's another sort of marriage.
It is. And it seemed to work quite well. And I always found it very seductive. And also, it helped me because when you go backstage and you're going through the stage door and you're waiting, something like a Buddhist chant that is so beautifully executed can really ease those pre-performance nerves. So if it's done with synthesizer or with more classical music, it didn't seem to bother. It seemed to work very, very well together.
Well, I think the composer, who in fact was Jean-Philippe Riquiel, had got absolutely into the nature of them. Mm. So he was just holding quiet chords.
Yes.
And he was kind of chanting on his instruments, as it were.
Absolutely.
And we heard Lama Gyurme. That was the Buddhist Vajra chant, which is the Dharma chant, number 8, Refuge, 7, Fold Offering. A very different sensibility now. Stephen Berkoff, and I suspect here that the performer is almost as important as the piece.
I had heard this young man, who was young at that time, called Ivo Pogorelic, and he was an extraordinary performer, unusual, innovative, quite dynamic, and I believe he's from Yugoslavia, but he had won, or was a contender for a very big prize in Moscow. He didn't win, but there was a lot of controversy at the time. And by chance, through my partner, we met him. And I saw this young man of most extraordinary looks. I mean, he had a look like a kind of angel, like a cherub. And not only was he gifted with these incredible looks by nature to make him so extraordinarily beautiful, but he could play like an angel. So I thought, this is very unfair. How can you both look like that and play like a wizard? So I became more and more fascinated by his music. And he played with a virtuosity and a technical skill which was utterly breathtaking.
Thank you.
That was the second movement from the Sonata No. 32 in C minor, Opus 111, by Beethoven, or rather part of it, the Ariata. Very inventive music, which almost, especially in the hands of Ivo Pogorelich, almost seems to be taken on into the world of Jelly Roll Morton.
It does, and many people, of course, are amazed that Beethoven seemed to anticipate the jazz era. So there must be something inside us that has this rhythmic feeling. So jazz doesn't just belong to the 20s or the 10s, that maybe it's something that's within us, a need to have this kind of strange, rhythmic, almost percussive sense of composition.
Well, I suppose, Stephen Meckoff, it's all that thing of rhythm goes back to our earliest kind of experiences, the human heartbeat, variations on it. And another thing that does that is the human voice, of course. Yes. And in different cultures, people use the human voice, as we heard in the Buddhist track.
Indeed.
In ways that sound strange to us at first, but actually magical once you get to know them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the human voice is very, very exciting when used together as a kind of ensemble. And the human voice, which I've chosen in the Monkey Dance piece, which I first got introduced to when reading the works of Antonin Artaud, who was a great French theoretician, a writer, actor, and a man of absolutely ferocious passions. And he found that the theatre of the time, this is 1920s, the French bourgeois theatre was simple, lame, inert, inactive, pathetic reflections of the bourgeois society. You know, dining rooms, people having dinners, adulterous affairs, much like the theatre we have today.
I was going to say, dare I say it, a bit of a role model for your good self.
Well, a little bit. I was amazed by him, and I read the book. And from the very first page, I was completely captivated by not only everything he said, but the way he expected us to understand him, to identify with him, because he was liberating us. He said, free yourself from all this stultification, from this, what he called, investment theatre, where you invest in them backers and, you know, it's for the bourgeois audiences who just want to be satisfied with their mirror image of themselves. So he spoke about his influences. In Paris in 1932-33, there was a music festival where the Balinese group of dancers and musicians came to perform. And when he saw them, they were doing the monkey dance. He was so astounded. He felt that this was everything he's been trying to express, that he believed in. He was trying to communicate that there is a power in the human voice and a strength and an energy which is so awesome that we lose it if we are obsessed with trivia. And he saw the monkey dance. It's a strange piece where the whole village is involved. And of course, in Bali at that time, you didn't get professional actors and then we all sit in the theatre a bit stuffily with a programme. The whole village is the theatre. So with the monkey dance, it's a group of circles round and round each other, going round and spiralling out to the outer circle where the children are at the very, very edges, learning and picking up from the older people who are deeper and deeper into the centre. And in the centre is a small area to perform. And this is about the monkey dance. This is about the monkeys in the forest who are warning the princess when the demon comes and that she's in danger. And they warn her by this extraordinary chorus of monkey sounds. But the amazing thing is, it's not scored, it's not written down. They have the chorus leader who at a certain point hits a note, which then tells them. So it's very, very well harnessed, very well organized, but looks completely spontaneous. Well, it is. This isn't exactly Noel Coward, but it's something that is so extraordinary. How in this small village in Bali, where people would come up with something like this, where would this inspiration, this idea, this creativity come from?
Well, obviously, it came through generations.
Yes, through many, many generations, yes.
I'm fascinated that... They should have toured that, because it had a great influence on composers. In fact, they toured here as well, where I think it was recorded. But people like Messiaen were very influenced, and you can see that in a piece like Saint-Croix-Chant. So, again, you get that amazing crossover of sound. That was an anonymous Balinese song ritual, the monkey dance, Kakak. Stephen Berkoff, we were talking about that and Arto, and that release of absolute natural energy, which, if you like, transcends convention. And of course, when you really got going, what you were doing was before Complicité or Nihai,
yes,
those more experimental countries. So there was a connection there, wasn't there? You're trying to take...
I think there was. Yeah. And one was always seeking for kind of people who would support in some way or enhance what you were doing. And so people like Antonin Artaud or these great American experimental groups in the 60s were people from whom I gained a great deal of inspiration.
It won't surprise anyone who's been listening to us to hear, especially from sort of a politico-socio side of things, that Mother Courage and Brecht, the world of Brecht, was important to you.
Well, initially, I got to know Brecht through British productions, and they weren't that inspiring. But then one day, of course, I saw the Berliner Ensemble, so I saw an astonishing actor called Eckhard Schall in a play of his called Arturo Uy. And that performance was absolutely an incredible piece of physical virtuosity. He had been a dancer, Eckhard Schall, and the way he used his body was not to act realistically the part of Hitler or Arturo Uy, but to comment on it, to satirise it. And that's the kind of theatre I was looking for, and looking for in Bertolt Brecht. And in particular, Mother Courage. I had seen a production in New York many years ago, which was astounding, by a place called the Performance Garage in the east side of New York. And that was quite remarkable. Directed by a man called Richard Schechner. That's fascinating. But then I heard the production on a cassette of Mother Courage, and I realised what I had been missing in the productions I'd seen is that they failed to use the music from Paul Dessau. Now, this music completely captured not only the text, but the physical movement of the play, which is this incredible, dynamic old woman pulling her cart of goods behind her round and round. And when I've seen it here, I often say to myself, why aren't they using Paul Dessau's music? They commission another musician. They somehow have tin ears. Can't they hear what this man is doing? I think, is it a copyright problem or some other problem? But they are missing the whole source, joy and inspiration of this production, because it is the combination of Brecht and Dessau which makes this particular piece of music so powerful.
Courage, sie erst kurieren mit Wein von
Helene Weigel with the Brecht-Dessau marching song from Mother Courage. Well, finally, Stephen Berkoff, we're going to have a famous trumpeter who has actually put down on this occasion his trumpet.
As a child, or a young teenager of 15, my love was classical music. I don't know where it came from. My mother played the piano a little when she was a child. She was actually became quite good, but we never listened to classical music in the house. But then I suddenly found myself loving jazz. Stan Kenton or Dave Brubeck or Jerry Mulligan, Paul Desmond. And one of the people we loved was Chet Baker. There was something about his music which was sulphurous. It seems you get this voice through years of abuse, through years of smoking cigarettes, dope, hash, marijuana, skunk, heroin, alcohol, and you are totally destroyed. And once the outer shell of the human being has been somehow cracking up, pulling away, peeling off, the psyche comes out. Something comes out of Chet Baker which is near to angelic, almost phenomenal. This is a man who hadn't trained his voice, who played his trumpet, was a phenomenal player. But suddenly, on the mic, he sings, and this voice can only come out of some being that had been almost pulverized by himself, of course. But what was left was this small angel.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change your hair for me. Not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine. Stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
Well, he had it all in one sense, and also had it had nothing. If you think of the looks, the gifts as a trumpeter, and then the gifts as a singer, and then also the sort of destruction.
It's a very odd thing. He reminds me of a certain young men that have too many gifts, and they have these looks and this talent and this breathtaking, wonderful, imaginative gifts for playing music, for singing. And it's a kind of almost a theme that runs from Arthur Rimbaud, who was this great poet, beautiful, could write poetry almost just poured out of him, so simple, so easily. And people like Chet Baker, musicians who have everything, and for some reason they have a need to implode. I don't know what it is. I've seen it in classical pianists. As if the strain and the stress of having your nerves stretched out so much to pick up your radar, detecting every single nuance of human experience. And I suppose maybe it's best not to be too gifted.
Stephen Berghoff, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me here.
Stephen Berghoff was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear Margaret Mountford, well known as one of Lord Sugar's former colleagues on The Apprentice, and she'll be talking about her love of music. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper.
Radio 3 live in concert, with Nicola Benedetti playing Vivaldi's Four Seasons. One of the UK's leading violinists with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, live from Glasgow's City Halls. And during the interval, Radio 3's Discovering Music uncovers the motivation behind Vivaldi's most popular work. Radio 3 live in concert, Friday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, it's just after 1 o'clock, and this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's time now for the news with Susan Ray.
The Formula One Grand Prix is getting underway in Bahrain, despite widespread calls for it to be cancelled. There's unprecedented security at the circuit, where the Bahraini authorities have deployed armed police, sniffer dogs and armoured vehicles. There have been days of violent clashes between anti-government demonstrators and security forces. Tensions are high after the death of one protester. The convicted fraudster Michael Brown is in the process of being extradited to Britain from the Dominican Republic. The multimillionaire, who was once a major donor to the Liberal Democrats, arrived in the Spanish capital, Madrid, yesterday. British officials will now try and bring him back to London. The government says it's taking seriously claims that MI5 breached the confidentiality of Libyans granted asylum in Britain after fleeing Colonel Gaddafi's regime. The Mail on Sunday says their details were passed to Libyan spies. The international envoy to Syria, Kofi Annan, has urged Damascus to stop its use of heavy weapons and fulfil a pledge to withdraw from populated areas. Mr. Annan has welcomed the UN's approval of up to 300 peace monitors for Syria. Polls have opened in France's presidential election. The centre-right incumbent, Nicolas Sarkozy, is seeking re-election, but he's facing a strong challenge from the socialist candidate, François Hollande. The Speaker of the Australian Parliament has stepped down amid allegations that he sexually harassed another man. Peter Slipper has denied the claims, but says he's standing aside while a criminal investigation takes place. The London Marathon has been won by Kenya's Wilson Kipsang. The women's title went to Mary Katani, another Kenyan athlete, for the second year in a row. Britain's David Weir won the wheelchair race for the sixth time. Most of the 37,000 competitors are amateurs, hoping to raise millions of pounds for charity. And the weather, there'll be showers in most areas this afternoon. These will be heavy in places, with hail and thunder. There'll be some sunny spells in between. It'll be quite a chilly night, with showers largely easing. BBC News at 1:03.
Read by Susan Ray. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. Just looking ahead to 2 o'clock and our Sunday concert, we'll be hearing the Pacifica Quartet playing two string quartets by Shostakovich, numbers 14 and 15. And that's followed at 4 by Choral Evensong, another chance to hear Wednesday's service from the Chapel of Keble College in Oxford, with music by Vaughan Williams, Malcolm Boyle and Rager. That's 4 o'clock Choral Evensong. But now it's time to join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show.
Hello. When it comes to bringing up children, people often wonder about the business of nature versus nurture. can talent be learnt, or is it simply something that runs in the genes? That certainly seems to be the only explanation for the extraordinary talent that was passed down the generations of one of the greatest dynasties in musical history, namely the Bach family. Of course, we all know about the great J.S. Bach. We've been hearing part of his Magnificat, and music written by his sons is also heard a lot these days. But today we're going to trace the family quite a bit further back to uncover some of Bach's musical ancestors, most of whom, incidentally, are rather confusingly all called Johann. And we begin in the first half of the 1600s in the central German region of Thuringia. J.S. Bach is known to have mentioned his great-great-grandfather, a baker named Veit Bach, who lived in Wechmar, and who apparently used to accompany the motion of his mill wheel by playing upon his cittern. He died in or around 1577, but not before he'd produced a Johann himself, who in turn spawned three musical sons. And it's here that we begin our genealogical journey, with music by two of them, Johann and Heinrich. Now, this Johann Bach is really the first of the Bach composers whose works have come down to us. He was born in 1604 and became a town musician in nearby Erfurt, piping chorales and popular tunes on the hour every hour from the top of the city tower. Pretty tough job, you could say, not least with all those perilous stone steps to run up and down. And a year later, presumably to supplement his income, he also took on a job as a church organist. So just two motets by Johann survive. This is Unser Leben ist ein Schatten, Our Life is a Shadow, performed by Collegium Vocale, Ghent.